From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Here's a striking statistic. As of Friday, the grand total of Western military personnel killed by the enemy in Afghanistan is zero. The number of journalists killed is seven. The latest calamity happened on Monday on a strip of dusty highway halfway between Jalalabad and Kabul. A convoy of reporters, photographers, translators, and their drivers was stopped by gunmen identifying themselves as Taliban fighters. Most of the vehicles were able to flee, but in two episodes a short while apart, four journalists were pulled out, verbally abused, stoned, and finally shot dead. They were Azizullah Haidari, a photographer for Reuters, Julio Fuentes, a writer for Madrid's El Mundo, Maria Grazia Catulli, a reporter for Corriere della Sera in Milan, and Harry Burton, a Reuters videographer. Take note of their names. By next week, they will be footnotes, regarded by some as anonymous heroes, and by many others, with a shrug, as reckless macho fools. Their grieving colleagues and their indifferent critics say the same thing. They knew the risks. Yes, and it's worth rehashing them. Imagine this for a moment. You go to another country, a stranger in unfamiliar terrain, unable to speak the language. You sleep badly. You bathe seldom. Food and water is scarce and suspect. You drive roads that are often mined or patrolled by combatants. A brutal enemy despises you. The civilian population may hate you as well. And the good guys' warplanes can damage you collaterally in one explosive instant. In Afghanistan, add to the mix the shifting alliances of ruthless warlords, and the only weapon you have to protect yourself against the Kalashnikovs is a laminated press badge. As we have seen in recent conflicts, beginning with the Gulf War, superpower air and armored warfare can be accomplished at great distances, well insulated from hostile fire. War reporting offers no such luxury. It can be accomplished seriously only on the ground, at the front, in harm's way. That may or may not be foolish, but it sure as hell is macho. And not to belabor the obvious about the four who lost their lives on Monday and their fellow future footnotes, the free world cannot live without them.
As Mazar-e-Sharif in Kabul fell to the Northern Alliance, images of women shedding their burqas and men shaving their beards filled television screens in America and, for the first time in half a decade, in Afghanistan. Against that backdrop, it's tempting to think of the battle for the hearts and minds of Muslims as an afterthought. But public relations, so to speak, is more than a tactic of war. If used effectively, it can ensure the peace. Joining me now is Shibli Telhami, the Anwar Sadat Professor for Peace and Development at the University of Maryland. Welcome to the show.
My pleasure.
Now, President Bush has declared that this war is not just a battle against the Taliban, but for the hearts and minds of the Arab world. Do you think that our weaponry is suited to this terrain?
It's very difficult to win the hearts and minds in the short term. And if you don't trust the messenger, it's very difficult to trust the message. If, for example, you focus your diplomacy on American officials, politicians going on Middle Eastern TVs, it can backfire because they're going to have in the back of their mind how they're going to be quoted in newspapers like the New York Times, the Washington Post, or radio stations like NPR. And as a consequence, they're going to frame their issues through a narrative, the very narrative, that is the subject of anger in the region.
What is it that an Arab audience will have in the back of its mind when listening to these politicians or their defenders?
For example, when people are asked, why hasn't the president met with Yasser Arafat? The American explanation is he hasn't done enough to stop the violence. And they have to repeat that because that is the explanation that works here. In the Middle East, people don't accept that because they have a narrative which says, no, the violence is going the other way around. Well, by repeating that argument, instead of persuading them, we're only reinforcing their fears.
Would you be able to suggest two or three things that the United States could do, say, within the next month?
One is we have to revive the Arab-Israeli peace process. It's a symbolic issue because it's an identity issue for much of the Arab world. Number two, we should be able to inspire hope in a economic and political change by launching a major economic forum. I wouldn't say so much economic aid in the short term, but I would say engaging governments and publics in the region and private business and international community to, again, inspire hope that something will work. Number three, we can use, in my judgment, people the region is likely to listen to, not so much our politicians, but, for example, Arab and Muslim Americans, people who have sensitivities, who understand the sensitivities in the region, who can speak as Americans, whether they're business people or lawyers or segments of the American society who go out there, you know, to begin cultural exchanges across the board. I think those are much more important than having any kind of a television public relations campaign.
Well, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Shibli Telhami is the Anwar Sadat Professor of Peace and Development at the University of Maryland. Since September 11th, Americans have been asking, why do they hate us? But as we move on, the more pressing question becomes, how do we stop them from hating us? When a child is born in poverty, raised in brutal conditions, and taught in religious schools to hate the West, where do you start? How does someone from an open society even begin to understand that degree of indoctrination? Ottmar Rudolph is an emeritus professor of German and the humanities at Reed College in Portland, Oregon. That's today. But Professor Rudolph was born in 1929 and raised in Nazi Germany. For his first 15 years, everything he knew was filtered through the lens of Nazi ideology. The analogy is far from perfect, but we thought we could shed some light on the monumental PR problem we face. Professor Rudolph, welcome to OTM.
Thank you.
So when did you first begin to come under the influence of Nazism?
When I went to school, I would say basically about when I was 10 years old. The war was then going well. It was 1939, 40, and the victories were left and right. And that, of course, was elating to us young boys.
You were in the Hitler Youth?
Yes, all of us. It was mandatory to go into the service of the Hitler Youth. And we, as young boys, enjoyed it. We liked it. If I wouldn't have my family, this could have easily been the route towards a SS soldier. I came home one day with a picture of Adolf Hitler, and I wanted to put it on my wall. My father was irate and took it right down. My mother said, listen, this is our Führer. Why don't you let him do it? This is the first time I saw and heard my father and my mother argue in a way which you can't understand. I could have easily turned him in, and he would have been sent to a camp or at least to a prison if I would have turned it in, as many young people did.
But it never occurred to you to do that.
No. I think my bonds to my father and especially to my mother were much greater.
Given the intense bombing that was going on, it's not hard to imagine the German attitude towards the Allies.
Yes, my home city was destroyed, 68%, 69%. There were terror bombings, which we call terrorists. I even wrote an essay for my school class in German titled, We Shall Pay Them Back, These War Gangsters.
What was your first encounter with the Allies like?
My first seeing of an Allied soldier was American. And we saw the American GI coming in on their jeeps with their uniforms, which were, we considered, no uniforms. How could they have such a uniform? Look at the German uniforms. What kind of boots did they have? They had rubber soles. Look at the German boots. That's manly. I mean, there were no soldiers. How in the world could they conquer Germany? I discovered very soon how generous they were, giving chocolate, of course, also chewing gum, which we liked in that time, and food. And that helped immediately to break that vicious circle of Nazi propaganda.
So the bombing of the cities that was supposed to instill terror instead built rage, and the distribution of food helped to dissipate it.
Yes, and I should add to that, very soon came perhaps the most important food package in my life, a care package. And we received quite a few of those care packages to really change our minds towards the Allies, and especially in that respect to America. The Americans were never really hated as such. It is just that the Jews rule America. That's the way we were taught. And then, of course, the bombing didn't help either. But that dissipated because of food packages.
When did you begin to hear the truth about what had been going on during the war?
I came over in 49 to New York, at the city where many, many Jewish people lived. That's where I first time heard of a concentration camp. I understood that the Jews were not tolerated. I understood that the Jews were put into camps, but that they would be annihilated. It slowly dawned on me that the big lie, which Dr. Goebbels fed us daily through his speeches, was just a big lie. I could probably say that I was, as a young boy, a kind of a militarist. I believed in the military power of a man. And that slowly dissipated while I was in New York. For instance, I never heard of the author Kafka while I was in Germany, because he was Jewish, of course. So one of the greatest German writing authors, Kafka, I would not even know. I slowly saw what was happening to me, that this was a 15 years of brainwashing.
You mentioned Goebbels, who was a master and an innovator in many ways of manipulating the mass media in all of its aspects.
That evil genius, Dr. Goebbels, who, as you know, was minister of propaganda in a dictatorship, in a totalitarian state, propaganda becomes so essential that they even bring it up to a ministerial position. And the power this man had over the media, including radio, movies, well, all of the media, what we have, was so great that a vacuum existed after it was over.
As you look at what's going on now in Afghanistan, and as you read about the madrasas that teach young Islamic men how to hate the West, what do you suggest the West should do, given your experience?
The first thing is that we must understand their culture and then bring in a propaganda, yes, a propaganda, with native speakers who will be able to tell them about the truth which really we live by, an entree to our culture, but not go against their culture and say, you are evil.
And care packages?
That is the best way of bringing the people to understand that we are loving and caring people, which America is.
Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Ottmar Rudolph is an emeritus professor of German and the humanities at Reed College in Portland, Oregon.
Coming up, ads that choke your email and ruin your dinner, and how to take revenge.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. In a Gallup poll released this week, Americans were asked to assess the performance of various institutions handling the war. At the top of the list was President Bush, with an 89% approval rating, followed closely by Secretary of State Colin Powell. Homeland Security Chief Tom Ridge managed an unimpressive 60%. Bringing up the rear were the news media, with the pathetic approval rating of 43%. And yet a poll conducted just after September 11th gave the media a robust 89. Why the slide? The Gallup analysts suggest that the role of reporters as skeptics and bearers of bad news have put them in direct conflict with the public mood.
Some of that bad news has involved the coverage of civilian casualties in Afghanistan. And with precious little word from the Pentagon and all too much from the Taliban, the networks have been hard-pressed for accurate numbers. The Taliban, of course, are hostile to Western press, except when showing off ghastly images for consumption on the infidels' home front. And at least one conservative press watchdog believes that at least one news organization is playing into the enemy's hands. The Media Research Center in Washington tallied the number of minutes the three major networks have devoted to the subject of civilian deaths. Coverage on CBS amounted to 4 minutes 17 seconds. NBC's total was 8 minutes 9 seconds, but leading the pack with 15 minutes 44 seconds was ABC. Media Research Center founder Brent Bozell charges ABC with coverage that is dangerously out of line.
Number one, for a reason I don't quite understand, ABC is obsessed with the notion of U.S. casualties. If you look at it, it's twice as much as the rest combined. The second thing that is noteworthy is that even in its obsession with this topic, what ABC has reported while reporting these stories is that they can't confirm anything they're reporting, which I thought was a no-no in journalism. I thought you confirm things and verify things before you put them on the air.
Brent, are you a statistician?
Yes. We look at these things.
Okay, well, I'm not. But I do know this, that in a universe of thousands of minutes, the difference between 5 minutes of coverage and 15 minutes of coverage is 10 minutes, and it's statistically insignificant. You cannot draw a conclusion except that ABC has a 10-minute difference in news judgment.
When one network is giving that topic more coverage than the other ones combined, then it is out of sync with the other ones.
The networks are frequently criticized by conservative groups about, you know, marching in liberal lockstep. But now you're pointing out that viewers tuning into different networks would get very different stories about the war. When did that become bad?
Well, I think when America is at war, you are an American first and a journalist second. And a journalist who can't accept that, is a deplorable person. You are always an American first. That doesn't mean that you compromise your principles. It doesn't mean you get yourself involved in misinformation or disinformation or anything of the sort. You can still pursue the truth.
All right. Not to be argumentative about this.
You?
But I just can't help myself.
Go ahead.
I understand that your organization makes a living finding fault with the press, particularly to the extent that the press is deemed a liberal or irresponsible. Is it possible that there is somebody who's obsessed here, but it isn't ABC, that it's you, that you're so obsessed and so frustrated with the press in general, that you're using this fairly insignificant difference in the amount of coverage on this one story as a not particularly salient example of your overall gripe with the press?
In fact, I have gone out of my way, and I'll say it on this show as well, to say that in the aftermath of the September 11th atrocity, I believe the media as a whole, with one or two insignificant exceptions, behaved in such an extraordinary manner. They showed a humanity, a professionalism, and a sense of patriotism that just made me so darn proud of every single one of them. I mean that sincerely.
Wow, this is a historical moment.
I mean that. And then I went and I got medicine.
Brent Bozell, a delight as always.
Thank you, sir.
Brent Bozell is the founder and president of the Media Research Center in Washington, D.C.
I love my computer, but increasingly I hate my email because several times a week I get about a dozen messages about hot, hot, hot college girls and stuff like that. Bob, should I forward those to you?
Please don't be ridiculous. Yes.
In the 21st century, spam is no longer first and foremost a luncheon meat. It's a sign to push the delete key over and over again. Reporter Jad Abumrad has this dispatch from the front lines of the war on spam.
A year ago, most of us were getting 16 a week. They appear without warning, all caps, exclamation points.
Find out anything about anyone. Are you feeling secure? Enlarge the size of your...
All right, that's enough. Point is, in just 1 year, the number has doubled to 30. That's according to two different studies, one by Gartner Research, the other by direct marketing giant DoubleClick. 30. I thought that was a lot. That is until I met Chip Sprickman.
This is my today's spam that came into my mailbox. It was 111 messages.
Chip is a systems administrator for the Internet Channel, the company that works behind the scenes to make my email work. I asked him to open my mailbox and analyze the previous night's offerings.
Explode your business by accepting credit cards. Viagra and more. Oh, there you go. See, that's a good old fake one there.
The ubiquitous Viagra spam is a perfect illustration of how tricky spammers can be. First of all, the return address was forged. What's more, Chip says, the spammer hijacked someone else's mail server to send out their message. It's what's known as a relay. In this case, the victim was a small Virginia consulting firm, Issue Dynamics Incorporated.
Good morning, Issue Dynamics Inc. Jackie speaking. May I help you?
Are you aware that someone is secretly using your mail service to send out spam?
No, but let me transfer you to someone that can help you there with that.
The company's president, Sam Simon, assured me that IDI had just fixed the problem after several user complaints. In the case of email fraud, the situation is clearly defined. 18 states have laws that make it illegal to send an email with a fake address. But what happens when an email is not fraudulent and you still don't want it? Should it be banned? No one seems to agree.
Well, first up, spam is legitimate. You know, let's start from there.
Jim Conway is the vice president of government relations for the Direct Marketing Association in Washington. The DMA argues that spam, like speech, should be tolerated as long as it's free of lies.
It's really come from left field where people have made a perception that this is a privacy issue. Where is the privacy? How is your privacy violated by turning on your annoyance, perhaps?
Conway is lobbying Congress against a bill that would impose penalties of up to $500 per message.
For what? Just because someone receives an email with an offer of a product that they can simply, with the click of a mouse, get rid of it?
But the click and get rid of it argument doesn't fly with anti-spam crusaders like Ann Mitchell. She is the legal director of the organization MAPS, short for Mail Abuse Prevention System. Spamming, she says, is not like other forms of marketing, and that the person being marketed to is the one that has to foot the bill.
You know those telemarketers who call you during dinner? Okay, how annoying is that? Imagine if they called you collect and you were required to accept the call. That is what junk email does to you.
For an individual email account, the cost is only a few pennies in download time. But for email providers like Earthlink or Hotmail, it can mean thousands of dollars in additional hardware and software to protect their users. So MAPS has taken matters into their own hands. They've created the real-time black hole list. A simple list, they say, of sites they believe send out spam.
We are really no different than Consumer Reports or a restaurant reviewer.
But e-marketers don't see it that way. They say landing on that list is the equivalent of being locked away in a padded cell with no windows, effectively censored. The reason? Nearly half of all internet service providers not only subscribe to the black hole list, they also use it as a giant email filter. Several times this year alone, emailers have sued MAPS after being consigned to the black hole. But Mitchell contends that MAPS only compiles the list, and it's for others to choose how to use it.
You know, could you imagine McDonald's suing a restaurant reviewer for panning the Big Mac?
The thing everyone agrees on is that an email isn't spam when the user gives permission to receive it. But the question is, what constitutes permission? Most marketers say it's enough for users to check a box on a website. But MAPS says this would not stop others from signing you up for lists without your knowledge, which is why they require marketers to ask users for a second email confirmation. To Court Cunningham of DoubleClick, this is overkill.
We actually did some research, and consumers actually found that to be annoying. You know, I already opted in once. Why are you asking me again, sort of thing?
Another side effect of MAPS' war on spam is friendly fire. For example, Chip Sprickman's dad was using a cable modem he got through Verizon to try and email his son.
I got a call from my dad saying, hey, did you get my email? And I'm like, no. And I'm like, oh, wait, let me look in my spam folders. And I looked, and a couple of Verizon's outgoing mail servers were blocked.
Nonetheless, it's a price Chip says he's willing to pay. And for right now, it remains his decision.
I mean, like, the thing that really got me is, like, you know, I was at home on the 11th, and, like, in the midst of, like, all that's going on that day, I'm still seeing make money fast. And then the past couple of weeks, I've been seeing, like, spam for anthrax cure, and it's just, like, they don't stop.
Post-9/11, Congress has put off considering anti-spam measures. But just imagine how that debate would shake the august halls of Congress. For On the Media, I'm Jad Abumrad.
Before there were annoying ads in your email, there were annoying ads on the telephone, delivered personally by a fleet of telemarketers with singularly bad timing. But then, when is a good time to hear about great savings on replacement windows? Frustrated and heretofore unrecorded country singer Tom Mabe decided to fight back by torturing those unwanted callers with a variety of outrages.
We're a nonprofit organization, and we're calling you today in hopes that you'd be willing to help someone less fortunate than yourself.
You just hit my heart. You know, I do so much charity work. I pay the conjugal visits down at the prison. Don't get me wrong. Some of these guys just need to be held.
Tom Mabe, I guess the question that all of America is asking is, what the hell is the matter with you?
I got tired of MCI calling me more than my friends and family did. You know, I'm financially embarrassed waiting for the phone to ring, you know, being a musician and working out of the house. And it kind of, like, I just, you know, I'm like, I like having fun. I just started, I had my little $37 answer machine. I hit the memo button and started recording.
What's your favorite one?
Low Self-Esteem, the first cut, is kind of like My Sweet Home Alabama. Everybody knows me by that cut. You know, hey, yeah, that's the kind of the hit off the CD.
Hello.
Is this Mr. Maybe?
Yes, sir.
This is Cheryl calling on behalf of A-Card.
Tell you what, ma'am, I just got a call from my boy's school. His school counselor called up and said that he had low self-esteem and he needed more encouragement at home. I tell you what, I try to encourage him all the time to be half as good as his brother. But go ahead.
Okay, sir. The reason for my call... As a valued card member, in the next 2 to 3 weeks, you will be receiving a 30-day no-risk trial.
30-day no-risk trial? Well, I wish the hell I had that kind of guarantee on my board.
Is he sitting right there with you?
He's right there. Sit down there, quit your crying, and be quiet.
So maybe he needs a little more encouragement.
I tell you, encouragement. I encourage him all the time to be half as good as his brother.
Well, sir, I am a mother of three, and...
Your mother of three?
The way you are talking to him is not very encouraging.
I know there's a lot of musicians who they come up with a hit, you know, a top 10 hit, and mm-hmm. then they get sick of singing it.
Oh, yeah.
For the rest of their careers.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel that way about low self-esteem?
Yeah, kind of. You know, and plus I signed a 5-record deal with Virgin, and the thing is, telemarketers are catching on to me now, and so you know, I have to go to the state fair and just sign up for everything. You know, register to win, get my name on some list again, because they're not calling as much.
Why does this strike such a chord, such a resonant chord with listeners?
Well, because right now, when people are listening to us, there's a lot of them being interrupted by telemarketers. I mean, trying to feed the baby, trying to have dinner. I mean, geez, they call the most inappropriate times.
Was there a single moment of inspiration that you're most proud of, that you feel like God touched you?
Yes. First CD. It's called Tom Fires a Telemarketer.
Before we continue, I need to tell you that our supervisors periodically monitor these interviews to ensure quality and courtesy. Do you currently have a paid job?
Oh, yeah.
And are
I'm
you...
a porn star.
That's funny. I'm surprised I haven't met up with you because I'm a porn star, too.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
What movies have you appeared in?
All of them.
All right, then.
Okay.
Church Kendi, speaking, may I help you?
Hi, this is Dr. Thomas Mabe. I'm trying to get a hold of an employee of yours, Teresa Murphy.
Oh, hi. She won't be in till 1 o'clock.
Okay.
Doctor, do you have her home number?
No, I do not have it on me. That's why I'm calling her work.
Okay, so let me, I can give it to you.
Okay, thank you so much.
Okay, so let's hold on. 1 second. Here we go. Okay. And her number is 563.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you so much, Karen.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Woo!
Lisa, this is Tom Wrightson. I'm calling from Research Corporation.
Yeah?
I work in the quality control department. We had monitored a call that you had a couple weeks ago where you were claiming to be in the porn industry. And the company has a problem with that because the name is representing you with the porn industry. We can't have that.
I don't remember saying that.
Well, we have it on tape, and unfortunately, we're going to ask you not to come into work, and we'll mail you your check.
My God, you're serious, aren't you?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Okay, bye.
Then I had to call her back and say, hey. Just a prank.
Yeah, and now I understand that you feel like you have this spirit of vengeance that's underpinning this whole exercise, but do you ever feel bad? You know, these are people just, they have a job that's very unpleasant to you, but, you know, they're just making a living. Do you ever feel guilty?
You know, my cousin sells drugs, and he tells me the same thing. I said, man, you shouldn't be selling drugs. He said, hey, I got to make a living. I mean, if you could see the death threats I get. I mean, these are morons.
Death threats?
Death threats.
Tell me.
I'm a single mother. I'm just doing my job, and you'll die soon. Things like that. I mean, I've actually had 4 emails to the FBI. All kinds of stuff. Just totally, you know, you will die. That you will die soon is the one that sticks out of my head.
I can see how that might. There's one of your pieces on the second album. It's cut number 7 on your second album. It's about the telemarketer calls, you happen to be in the bathroom.
But, they don't care. You sit there and tell them you're in the bath. I was seeing how far I could push them. I'm just on the toilet right now. Well, sir, reason why we're calling, I mean, you just, well, sir, and it doesn't bother them.
Don't you have, at long last, a certain grudging admiration for the persistence of some of these people? Who go right through the flowchart, go right to the next question, and seem completely unfazed by your theatrics.
They are so happy that I'm staying on the phone with them because the average telemarketing call is you get that 4-second pause and, hi, miss, I'm going to mispronounce your last name, and you just click. So they're just so happy I'm staying on the phone with them that they'll do anything.
Is it your goal to get them to hang up on you?
Yeah. Tell them if I hang up on them, it doesn't make the album.
And what happens when this is... when this is played out, and how long do you think it'll be before this is all played out?
I think there's one more CD before people just get tired of it. I want to do something else, like Revenge of the Drive-Thru Windows or something. I mean, I get tired of hearing it.
Tom Mabe, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Tom Mabe's second album is called Revenge on the Telemarketers, Round 2.
Coming up, propaganda old and new, and your letters.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. And here's when we dig into the OTM mailbag. We have this about our interview with Fawad Ajami about the Middle East news station Al Jazeera. Norman Bauman of New York City says Ajami's complaint is that Al Jazeera has moderators and guests who express opinions Ajami doesn't agree with. And he notes, the Wall Street Journal seemed to be impressed because Al Jazeera had great journalists getting exclusive stories, interviews with major figures, and reporting from places like Kabul that nobody else could get into. I think you as a journalist should respect Al Jazeera because they do a good job. I'm not sure your work would compare favorably.
And this from Corin Cranford of Charlotte, North Carolina, about our interview concerning recent news stories that describe in detail weaknesses in homeland security. She writes, Reporters can say that these stories are informative and will bring change until they are blue in the face. And I still say it's a security breach. Everyone is re-evaluating security and has been before September 11th. It is not news. Regarding our discussion about whether the press is hurting the war effort by being reflexively cynical, Jack Wall, also of Charlotte, had this to say about reporters. It's almost as if the perceived right to know and the role of protecting the people give reporters license to do whatever they want to or behave in whatever way they want.
Our discussion of the big media recount of the presidential election in Florida drew a strong response. We said that newspapers buried the finding that Gore would have won a statewide recount. Manny Schultz agrees that the headlines were confusing. My guess, he writes, is that this was intentional on the part of the editors. They wanted to avoid saying that the commander-in-chief of the United States forces fighting terrorism is not our duly elected president. But Kevin Bishop says, boo to us. Gore lost a very close election, but he did lose the election under the rules that were operating at the time. On that point, he adds, the headlines were crystal clear.
On Sarah Fischko's look back at the media coverage of the assassination of President Kennedy, Stephen Alexander, at that time an NBC News cameraman in Dallas, writes, I was 5 feet from Jack Ruby as he stepped forward, pulled the gun out, and fired into Oswald. I was 24 years old and had been in television news about 14 months. That event changed so many things, TV news, the presidency, and my life. I have never really deeply expressed my feelings about those events until hearing your story today, and I found myself crying.
And finally, here's one of many letters from North Carolina, pointing out our mistake when welcoming news station WUNC to the OTM fold. We said the station broadcasts from Raleigh. But as Josh from Durham points out, the UNC stands for the University of North Carolina, which anybody who has ever watched a basketball game or two knows is in Chapel Hill. How about a correction, he asks. Well, we can do better than that for our new friends in Chapel Hill. Go Wolfpack.
Tar Heels.
I knew that. Not long ago, an employee of an American news organization got a huge scoop, an interview with Taliban leader Mullah Omar. But is that a legitimate news story, or is it giving aid and comfort, or at least a propaganda forum, to the enemy? Complicating the question, the news organization in question was Voice of America, a U.S. government agency. The situation created an uproar, as documented by Washington Post writer Frank Ahrens.
What happened was this. A woman named Spojma Melwandi, who is the head of the Pashto service. There are two language services VOA specifically targets at Afghanistan, Pashto and Dari. Shortly after the bombing began, she called up one of the ministers of the Taliban, and essentially they said, he's not here, would you like to speak to the Mullah Omar instead? Which was a great, it's like calling up the White House and Ari Fleischer saying, I can't take your call, do you want to talk to George Bush? And in the service, in the Pashto service, what you heard was Spojma reading the story that said, here's the story that's coming, here's what's going on, here's a quote from George Bush. And they had Bush speaking, and then, of course, the interpreter changing it into Pashto. And he said, and here's a quote from the Mullah Omar. And here there was the direct quote from the Mullah Omar in the interview. VOA did not broadcast an unedited interview with the leader of the enemy that we're bombing. They didn't steady the soapbox of our enemy.
So this woman had the scoop of a lifetime, but the way it appeared on Voice of America opened her up to criticism and opened up Voice of America to criticism of at least the de facto support of the enemy. What have been the reverberations of this incident in the service?
Well, I think the reverberations were probably best described when I went over there a couple of weeks ago and sat in on one of their daily 9:30 morning news meetings. And a question came up about an interview with somebody, and the news director questioned that person very carefully, and there was a significant rise in the tension, and somebody leaned over to me and said, we're all operating under the shadow of Omar now.
Ultimately, when the question becomes, should they be a fairly even-handed broker of the news, or should they be more of a propaganda arm of the government, what do you suppose going forward the answer will be?
I think VOA is pretty well entrenched into what it does. I think in order for it to have a radical change, there has to be a change in its charter, which I think has to go through Congress. And it's hard to imagine that happening. I think what will happen is Congress probably will approve money for a Radio Free Afghanistan, which has gone through the Congress and I think is in the Senate now. Radio Free Afghanistan would say, here is our take on the news that's happening in your country. And interestingly enough, some of the people at VOA looked at the proposal of a Radio Free Afghanistan service as saying, well, it looks like Congress is ready to take the gloves off completely and just start pouring on the propaganda, because sometimes that's how the Radio Free services are viewed.
Frank Ahrens, thanks for joining us.
Thanks a lot, Bob.
Frank Ahrens is a reporter in the Style section of the Washington Post. Confusion about VOA's wartime role is complicated by its charter, which mandates three separate missions, some more journalistically pure than others. This sometimes perplexing combination of responsibilities is in the hands of a staff of experienced journalists headed by VOA Director Robert Riley. He joins us now. Mr. Riley, is it frustrating for you to be criticized on the one hand for being, I don't know, sinister propagandists, and then on the other hand, all of a sudden, for being apologists for terrorists? Do you get up in the morning sometimes going, I just can't win for losing?
Well, you see, it's a false dichotomy. What anyone needs to do who sees those as the only two alternatives is to read the charter by which VOA is guided by law. And it's in those three parts: to present accurate, comprehensive news, to responsibly represent the U.S. policies, and three, a projection of significant trends in American life and thought. Those are the respects in which we're the voice of America.
The voice of America is not new to this this situation since September 11th. Nonetheless, we've come to discover that Islamists have been promulgating a particularly hateful form of anti-Americanism throughout the intersecting Arab and Muslim worlds. Does Voice of America have to bear some responsibility for that, that it hasn't done a better job of counteracting this vitriol?
I'm happy to say that prior to the events of September 11th, our Board of Governors advanced a massive initiative for broadcasting to the Middle East, Islamic and Arab world to gain a much larger audience for the United States and a much larger venue through which we could explain our point of view. One would wish it had been funded earlier, but in my own visits to Capitol Hill, I am consistently hearing, forget the constraints of the past. Give us a persuasive case on what you need to do your job.
In other words, if you're asking somebody to subsidize your tourniquet purchase, it's best to show up hemorrhaging.
I see what you mean, that it's dramatized the situation, and it's unfortunate that it had to come to people's attention in this awful way. But it appears that we've learned something from that, and that this most powerful tool of U.S. public diplomacy, of being able to speak to the peoples of other countries directly, is now going to be taken seriously in a way that it hasn't been since the height of the Cold War.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Robert Riley is director of Voice of America in Washington, D.C.
Hubert Humphrey said in 1965, propaganda to be effective must be believed. To be believed, it must be credible. To be credible, it must be true. That could explain the ultimate ineffectiveness at the very time the vice president was intoning those words of the Pentagon's propaganda war over Vietnam. The military tried to sustain public support on a raft of lies, but it sank under the weight of the images. Alan Winkler is the author of The Politics of Propaganda.
As we saw the body bags coming back, as we saw the piled-up corpses, people turned against the war. And I think in its effort to avoid that kind of thing, administrations since that time have vowed it will never happen again.
And it's 1, 2, 3, what are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. Next up is Vietnam.
Winkler says the government's handling of Vietnam was a far cry from its letter-perfect treatment of the war against Hitler. That war engaged all of America, which, along with the ultimate sacrifice of its sons, tended its victory gardens, sold war bonds, saved rubber, cut down on little pleasures to advance the nation's cause.
But because of the huge quantities of candy required by our war fighters and war workers,
Your civilian candy counters may not always be able to fill your needs completely. You can help through your understanding and cooperation.
President Bush is trying to enlist the nation's support in much the same way by emphasizing the war at home, promoting volunteerism and symbolic gestures like American children sending dollars to their Afghan counterparts without actually calling for sacrifice, such as cutting oil consumption. Alan Winkler.
He's trying to get people engaged in activities like those of the Office of Civilian Defense during World War II, where volunteers were looking for airplanes and felt that they had a vested interest in the war effort. He's trying to get people to do the kinds of things they did during World War II, all of which created a sense of a participation and involvement.
Another effective World War II strategy, less employed in the current campaign, involved the relatively free flow of information.
They subscribed to what they called a strategy of truth. They didn't want to use information that was not true. Yes, there was military censorship. Yes, there were things that were not reported in explicit terms. But people fundamentally felt that they were getting a straight story.
This is a program of cruel, hard truth. Not for the squeamish or the timid. This truth is ugly and at times horrible. This is the truth about our enemy.
Do you think that the Bush administration is employing a strategy of truth?
I don't. I think that we don't really have a complete picture of what's going on in Afghanistan. I think the government would be serving its own interests by providing greater access to information, by trying to give a sense of what is happening, what may happen next, what the implications of that will be.
Winkler concedes the strategy of truth doesn't always work. Different eras, different conflicts call for different propaganda techniques, but some tactics endure from war to war. And according to journalist and historian Philip Knightley, the first is the crisis.
They say we've exhausted every possible diplomatic and other means of preventing the war, but everything has failed, and now we have to go ahead. Stage one.
Sometimes the crisis is palpable, undeniable, as we experienced on September 11th. Sometimes it needs a little, shall we say, punching up. Take the crisis that spurred America's entry into the Gulf War 10 years ago, Iraq's otherwise unstoppable invasion of Saudi Arabia from Kuwait. But there were pictures, courtesy of a Russian satellite, that showed there were no Iraqi troops gathering along the border.
Of course, the pretext for sending American troops to Saudi Arabia in the first place without congressional authorization was to defend against an invasion, an imminent invasion of Saudi Arabia from Kuwait by the Iraqi army.
Rick MacArthur is author of Second Front, Censorship and Propaganda in the Gulf War.
These satellite pictures contradicted that premise, but nobody published them, nobody used them until the St. Petersburg Times finally published them, but too late to have any impact.
Once urgency is established, says Philip Knightley, the propaganda war shifts into second gear.
Stage two is you have to demonize the enemy leader.
And so it has been with Osama bin Laden.
The British press actually ran a whole article headed Inside the Crazy Maniacal Mind of Osama bin Laden.
As florid as that rhetoric may be, few would quarrel with it. Sometimes the enemy is every bit as crazy as he is depicted, and so may be his followers and supporters, the third item on Knightley's propaganda checklist. And they, too, must be demonized.
Why has the Nazi mad dog won so many successes? Why did he sweep through the terrible years from triumph to triumph? Because never until now have good men everywhere taken united action against evil.
The new war is not only against the evildoers themselves. The new war is against those who harbor them and finance them and feed them.
According to Philip Knightley, the next stage is the atrocity story. Difficult to check, being that both victim and victimizer generally are unavailable for comment. One of the more notorious recent examples of a counterfeit atrocity hails from the Gulf War, Rick MacArthur.
It never happened. They just made it up, along with the Kuwaitis and the Hill & Knowlton public relations firm.
In October of 1990, a Kuwaiti teenager, later found to be the daughter of the ambassador, testified before the Congressional Human Rights Caucus that Iraqi troops were killing babies by dumping them out of incubators, 300 babies by final count. It was the centerpiece of a massive public relations campaign financed almost entirely by the Kuwaiti government.
The White House and the American government are capable of lying every bit as vigorously as the Taliban, yes. That doesn't make the causes morally equivalent. It just means that governments use propaganda during wartime and make wildly exaggerated claims.
The conduct of the Afghan campaign suggests that the current Bush administration is more likely to withhold stories than to plant them in the media. The government doesn't have to, according to Michael Beal, professor of electronic media at Morehead State University.
They don't have to do it directly. They're doing it indirectly. They're telling the reporters and the editors as to what the message of the day is. They don't have to go out and actually produce a TV program or a newscast to do it, because that would be labeled as propaganda. But if we now see this message being given to us by the newsmen that we trust, then that information gets across to us.
Today, there is no Committee on Public Information to lie about the battles, as in World War I, or Office of War Information to oversee the media messages, as in World War II. What we hear now is a cacophony of cryptic briefings from the podium, round-the-clock rat-a-tat from the talk shows, and serious reporting that ranges from the complacent to the cynical. By the time Hubert Humphrey delivered that quote I cited earlier, that propaganda must be true to be credible, history had already proved him wrong. Nazi lies were devastatingly effective. But Goebbels had a stranglehold on information, and that is not possible here today. Perhaps more appropriate is a line from the French playwright Jean Anouilh that goes, "Propaganda is a soft weapon. Hold it in your hands too long, and it will move around like a snake and strike the other way."
That's it for this week's show. On the Media's special Thanksgiving edition was produced by Janine Price and Katya Rogers, engineered by Scott Strickland, and edited by Brooke. We had help from Michael Cavanaugh and Andy Lancet. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl, and she is one.
Mike Pesca is
a Pearl. Mike, not a webmaster.
And this wasn't a
although, you know, she's also the webmaster.
This wasn't a special Thanksgiving edition. Mike Pesca is our producer at large. Arun Roth, our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and get free transcripts at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from National Public Radio. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm a special Thanksgiving edition of Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Ford Foundation, the Bidell Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.